Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, speaking of Senate races, check out today's Brian Lehrer Show news quiz question and see if you've been paying attention. We have a new question every day at our politics website. It's a freecountry.org. Today's question is, at a rally this week, Nevada's Tea Party Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, Sharon Angle, said all of the following things. Which got the biggest applause? She would cut the U.S. Department of Education. Her first act in the Senate would be to help repeal Obamacare. Or Dearborn, Michigan and Frankfort, Texas are on American soil but operate under Sharia law. Sharon Angle said all of those things at a rally this week. Which one got the biggest applause? See if you know the answer at itsafreecountry.org. Now, coming up in a little while, we will be celebrating John Lennon's 70th birthday, which is tomorrow. We're going to talk to Michael Epstein, director of the PBS documentary Lennon NYC. And as part of our tribute, we're going to do a group sing-along of Lennon's Give Peace a Chance, the first ever Brian Lehrer Show, John Lennon's 70th birthday sing-along to Give Peace a Chance. And if you want to participate, especially if you know the song well and think you can carry the tune on the radio, call us up right now at 212-433-WNYC. We're not going to put you right on the air. We're going to talk to you off the air because we're going to select four of you to participate, one lead singer for each verse of the song. Each one of you will get one verse, and then all four of you will participate in the chorus together. You know, all we are saying is give peace a chance. So we've got a karaoke background version of the song lined up to give you backing instrumentals. We've posted lyrics to the song. If you need to be reminded of the words, you can do this by reading. It's perfectly fine. Go there now to brush up on the track and make sure you're up to the task of singing Give Peace a Chance in our first ever Brian Lehrer Show, John Lennon 70th birthday chorus. And call us up, 212-433-WNYC, if you want to be one of the four people in that chorus. 212-433-9692. Audition call is now, 212-433-9692. And one of our producers will talk to you off the air. We'll do this on the air in a little bit later this hour. Who knows? It just might work. Now, when the financial crisis happened, museums took a hit, like everyone else, to their savings and donations, and some of them wanted to sell off artworks to cover operating expense shortfalls. That's a big no-no in the art world in general. And New York's Board of Regents, that's the state agency that oversees the state's cultural institutions as well as the schools, put in place emergency rules to make sure that it didn't happen here. Those rules expire today, and as the New York Times' Robin Pogrebin reported earlier this week, there's quite a bit of consternation about that decision. Merrill Tisch, chancellor of the New York Board of Regents, joins me now to talk about the decision, and we'll also ask her about another matter that the Board of Regents oversees that's been in the news, for-profit colleges. Welcome back to the show, Merrill Tisch. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here. It's extraordinary that John Lennon would have been 70 years old tomorrow. I think it gives my generation a lot of pause.
Indeed. And I can't wait to hear the tribute and the chorus we'll be putting together. Yeah. Selling art is so fraught in the museum world that they use a euphemism for it, right? It's called deaccessioning.
Correct.
So when is it okay for museums to sell part of their collections?
Well, let me just, if I might, go back to how you led into the story.
Uh-huh.
The emergency regulation is what is expiring on October 8th, leaving us back, reverting back to the old regulation. And in that old regulation, there is a clear prohibition against selling art for any other reason than to acquire, to preserve, or to protect your collection. And those, that will absolutely be in place. And that does not change. The confusion is that for the past 2 years, the state has operated with two sets of regulation, the regulation that existed and the emergency regulations, which were trying to be crafted as part of a legislative package. That was going no place in the legislature.
The legislation failed. So what were the emergency rules that you imposed?
The emergency regulations tried to tighten the language around the accessioning or deaccessioning of art throughout the state. What we were finding, however, was that for the past 2 years, there had been enormous confusion in the field, from the large cultural institutions downstate to the smaller cultural institutions upstate. And so what we decided to do was literally take a time out, let the emergency regulations expire. Over the course of the next 2 or 3 weeks, we will be appointing an advisory group made up of all of the interest groups in the cultural world to help give us direct input as to how to make this language clear and bulletproof, because there is no way that we would ever permit or go in a direction that would allow cultural institutions to deaccess to cover operating costs.
And as I understand the politics of it, it's the smaller institutions that might not have the bylaws or the deep-pocketed boards that can step in to prevent short-sighted selling of art actions, who really wanted these rules enacted to protect themselves. And it's the larger institutions like the Met and MoMA that lobbied against them?
No, that is only part of the story. Even the smaller institutions had a variety of issues that were coming before us in very conflicted ways. For instance, some groups wanted the buildings, their buildings, covered as part of their collection. Some of the smaller cultural institutions did not want that. There were dozens of issues across the board, small and large, that were just getting confused between the emergency regulations and the old regulations, and we just felt that instead of allowing this confusion to go forward, we would sunset the emergency regulation and try to convene this advisory group to help us come to a place that would allow us to present a balanced approach to craft public policy that kind of helped us thread the needle to meet the needs of the public, obviously, but also answer the demands of the institutions who are responsible for these collections.
Now, I'm going to digress for just a minute, because as we're collecting participants, really auditioners for our John Lennon Birthday Chorus,
yes,
it turns out, Chancellor Tisch, that
yes,
just like in middle school,
mm-hmm,
it's only the girls who want to join the chorus. So we have one opening remaining, mm-hmm, for a male vocalist, and we want men who would like to be part of this John Lennon Birthday Chorus and sing Peace Chance coming up in a few minutes, to call in. I mean, we have world-class male vocalists listening to this show. Sting might be listening to the show right now.
Oh, I hope he is.
Many of you in, you know, some of the most wonderful choruses in the world right here in New York City are listening. But I don't care if it's a professional singer.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, come on, guys.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, especially if you're of a certain age, we know you are John Lennon fans, and I know even my current middle schooler loves to sing John Lennon. Sorry, son, this is you're at school now, so you can't call it. But guys, and he's in the chorus. But guys, we need one more guy willing to sing John Lennon. 212-433-WNYC. Call us up right now. 212-433-9692. We need that Y chromosome in the chorus. Okay. Back to the question of museums selling off their arts for their art for operating expenses, mm-hmm, with New York State Board of Regents Chancellor Merrill Tisch. What caused the change of heart? Hadn't the board indicated that you would make the regulations permanent rather than let them expire today after the legislation failed?
No. There had been a lot of confusion, and frankly, we had been having a hard time messaging what our approach was, where we were on a variety of issues. We have heard from constituents from Staten Island to Binghamton to Utica to Elmira to the North Country. I mean, we have been hearing from all of, and what we've been hearing is a chorus, frankly, of confusion. And when you are affecting public policy in such a direct way as to impact cultural resources in communities, and you are getting this resonance of confusion, I think you've got to act quickly to try to end the confusion and say, we are going to take a time out here and try to recalibrate this in a way that will make sense for all of our constituent groups. And I think we'll be able to get there. I think there is very broad agreement on the important issues. It's the smaller ones that the smaller issues that I think that are going to prove to be thorny, but yet must be clearly delineated as part of final regulation. I think everyone's going to be happy when we're done, or happier. Or maybe I shouldn't say that, but it's what I'm projecting.
Let's hope. Now, yeah. I want to digress, and before you go, touch on one other issue that I gather you spoke about recently. It's for-profit colleges, which have been in the news. There was recently a U.S. Senate hearing about whether they basically defraud students by overpromising on employment prospects and dupe them into taking out loans that they won't be able to repay. And people have cited statistics showing, you know, high default rates and low employment rates among people who go to for-profit colleges. But I gather that you spoke out to defend the for-profit colleges in New York State. Is that correct?
I did. Unlike the other 49 states of our wonderful union, New York State's for-profit colleges come under the purview of the State Education Department. And over the last several years, we have acted aggressively to close some of these for-profit colleges, which have come to our attention as really being part of a great defrauding process. So we have a process in place in New York State that tends to weed out the bad providers. Having said that, I think it's a much more... It's a larger issue, if I might. What happens is the public, through school aid and through all of the financial assistance that goes into tuition assistance, et cetera, pays for our youngsters to go K through 12, get a high school diploma. Then many of them go on to community colleges, and because 75% of the youngsters coming out of our high schools need to be remediated at community colleges, that's not an efficient way to run an educational system. The same thing for for-profit colleges. In other words, we can't be putting public money in tuition assistance for young adults who are going to go into these programs expecting to get a job and training and preparation for a career, and then not have them get that. So we have a problem both at the community college level, at the for-profit college level, and I think what we need to do is address that very aggressively. But that does not mean that we should pillory the entire for-profit college community, because many of these programs, and I think of one in particular that is just has an outstanding reputation. I don't know if I can plug
that. You can name it. Go ahead.
It's the Monroe College. They have a really impressive track record. Not perfect, but really impressive. And so it's really significant not to allow with one broad brush to pillory an entire community of providers. I believe there's room for the for-profits. I believe they need to improve their practice. I believe that these hearings will shed light on bad practice and will allow the for-profits to re-level themselves to a place where they're meeting these higher standards. And I think that's good for the system.
So would Monroe College, for example, come up against the gainful employment rule that would not allow federal student aid to colleges whose graduates end up with low salaries and high debt? I gather a decision on the rule has been put off until next year.
I fortunately do not sit in the United States Congress those decisions. I think they're going to come up with a set of regulatory language that is going to really close out bad practice. Where they go exactly and how it ends up, I don't want to project, but I think everyone is focused on this. I would just urge everyone to understand that we don't want to close the for-profit industry.
There's a suspicion about it, just before you go, that, you know, a for-profit school is going to be in the business of taking money and not caring as much about the outcome as the massive not-for-profit university sector, you know, everything from Columbia and Harvard and Hofstra and NYU through the public universities, which are, of course, non-profit, SUNY, CUNY, Rutgers, everything else, that there would be a different incentive and somehow a corrupting incentive by definition in the for-profit sector. You reject that?
That is a complicated question that has a lot of moving parts to it. I reject an institution that rips off the public. And I believe in closing down bad practice and promoting good practice. And I believe that ultimately the language of the regulations will make it really difficult for bad practitioners to stay in business. And I think that will be great for the entire industry.
New York State Board of Regents Chancellor Merrill Tisch, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Have a wonderful weekend and happy birthday, John Lennon.
Thank you. Yes, we will celebrate John Lennon's birthday coming up in just a minute. Stay tuned.